This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight, in Sudan, the ruling military council says there has been deadly violence hours after a deal was reached with protest leaders about a transitional government.
Gunfire in the heart of Sudan's capital, Khartoum. Armed men in uniform fired in the air and at protesters at an ongoing mass sit-in Monday night, killing several and wounding dozens.
That was reporter Jason Patinkin. Also, a top United Nations humanitarian official warns the United Nations Security Council that one in six Cameroonians is in need of aid, and the Algerian government struggles to answer demands of protesters for change from the former leadership of Abdulaziz Bouteflika. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Sudan's ruling military council says at least five protesters and an army major were shot dead last night in the capital Khartoum, just hours before after the council reached a deal with protest leaders on a transitional authority. Jason Patinkin reports from Khartoum.
Gunfire in the heart of Sudan's capital, Khartoum. Armed men in uniform fired in the air and at protesters at an ongoing mass sit-in Monday night, killing several and wounding dozens. Sudan's Transitional Military Council blamed unidentified elements for the attack and said one military police officer, an army major, was among the victims. But it was unclear who was responsible for the shooting. Yasser Mohammed, a lawyer, spoke to VOA after fleeing gunfire on Nile Street just before midnight. He said, unfortunately, they can't say who attacked them. But from what he's seen and experienced, said Mohammed, it was likely shadow soldiers in the Secret Service who caused this massacre. Sudan's army has defended protesters against previous attacks on their weeks-long demonstration for civilian rule. But there are also military police, national security services, and a heavily armed Darfuri militia, the Rapid Support Forces, linked to ousted President Omar al-Bashir. Adding confusion is the belief among protesters that these various groups may be wearing each other's uniforms. Those with gunshot wounds were taken to nearby hospitals. But in a field clinic set up by protesters, dozens of wounded streamed in as gunfire crackled outside. Many suffered from tear gas that security forces fired at protesters. Others had head wounds and said they were beaten. Yusuf Al-Sayer said a member of the Rapid Support Forces, who was in uniform, beat him on Nile Street. He said, gunfire is usually normal, but people started running and Rapid Support Forces started coming under the bridge. I tried to hide since I have a disability and can't run, said Al-Sayer, but an RSF soldier started beating me. I yelled, I'm hurt, he said, but the soldier didn't listen and just kept beating. The violence came as a surprise as the ruling military council has been in talks with protest leaders for the past few weeks on forming an interim government. But the field clinic's Dr. Iman El-Tihani said the situation appears to be escalating.
The first few days of the sit-in, there was a lot of violence, to be honest, from the forces. And then there was a stillness or a calmness afterwards for almost a little less than a month. And now recently, especially today and yesterday, there's been like some sort of a relapse into the violence.
Monday night's violence seemed timed to upset progress in talks between Sudan's military and protest leaders on a transitional authority. The attacks came just hours after the military council announced they had reached a deal. Sudan's prosecutor general's office had also declared former President Omar al-Bashir had been charged over the killings of protesters. The military took power after ousting al-Bashir on April 11th from 3 decades of rule. The coup followed 4 months of anti-government protests, sparked by fuel and food shortages in which dozens were killed in clashes with security forces. Protesters erected barricades and blocked roads around Sudan's defense ministry, where they have been ever since demanding the military hand power to civilians. The funeral procession on Monday night carried the body of one of the killed protesters. The military council and protest leaders have said the violence will not stop them from forming a transitional government before holding elections. But with attacks on them increasing, protesters have to figure out which troops are with them and which are against them. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Sadiq al-Mahdi's career is one of the longest in modern Sudanese history, including two stints as prime minister. But amid an unprecedented upheaval that has seen mass street protests and a military coup, al-Mahdi says he will step away from partisan politics. Reporter Jason Patinkin spoke to al-Mahdi at his home in Khartoum. Here is his exclusive interview for VOA.
With a people-led revolution still rocking Sudan, former Prime Minister Sadiq al-Mahdi, the country's last democratically elected leader, might be expected to jump back into the political horse race. The 83-year-old leader has a reputation as a political survivor and returned to Sudan in December from a year in self-imposed exile amid massive anti-government protests. But instead, he says it's time for him to have a different role. Not only has his opposition Umma Party declined to be part of any transitional government, but Mahdi himself says he will not run in any future elections.
I will have no post in the transition or in the coming elections. In fact, I am looking for a different career. I will stand down in such political, partisan, and executive roles.
The announcement, made in a wide-ranging interview for VOA, marks a new era for politics in Sudan. Al-Mahdi has played a central role in Sudan's political life for over a half century. He was prime minister from 1966 to 1967, and again from 1986 until 1989, when he was ousted by an alliance of Islamists and the military led by former President Omar al-Bashir. Bashir ruled for nearly 30 years and was accused of corruption and committing war crimes in Sudan's Darfur region. The army ousted him in April after citizens across the country staged months of street protests against his rule. The mass demonstrations continue today as protesters are demanding the Transitional Military Council hand power to a civilian government. Although al-Mahdi is not taking a leading role in the protests since his return to Sudan, he has nothing but praise for the revolution.
This last revolutionary movement lasted for 4 months. This is longer than any period in the past. Such phenomena is completely new to Sudanese politics. And also what's new to it is the role of the youth. I thought the youth under this regime had had their future stolen. I thought they were a lost generation. In fact, they surprised me by being so dynamic and so patriotic. It looks and is an expression of the return of the soul to Sudan. Now this is a restoration of hope and honor for the country.
The ruling military council has been negotiating with protest leaders on a transitional government to govern until fresh elections. But despite an agreement Monday on the structure of a transitional authority, violence broke out after nightfall. Several protesters and one military officer were killed, and dozens of civilians wounded in what witnesses said were attacks by security forces on the demonstration. Speaking before the attacks, al-Mahdi urged the military and civilians to work together to organize quick elections.
I think the role of the military, who took power, military council, is to hold power, but make for a immediate and quick transformation of executive power to a civilian council of ministers. Civilians could be as autocratic as the military. So what we need is a quick general and free elections so that power is really handed over to the people. Of course, we cannot do that before dismantling the power centers of the outgoing regime. This should be agreed and should be implemented as soon as possible.
Sudan's protesters have since April refused to leave their sit-in around the defense ministry until a civilian government is in place. Most do not trust the military to willingly hand over power and point out that the military leaders still include those who supported Bashir and atrocities committed in Sudan's Darfur region. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Omdurman.
A top UN aid official says the number of people in Cameroon who need humanitarian aid has increased by 30% from last year because of conflict. Mark Lowcock, the Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs, told an informal meeting of the UN Security Council yesterday that 4.3 million people have been affected. Lowcock says one in six Cameroonians need aid. Half are children. Cameroon is divided between English and French-speaking groups. English-speaking separatists in the northwest and southwest are seeking independence from the French-speaking government. President Paul Biya has called the separatists terrorists. Hundreds of fighters have been killed and a number of armed groups are opposing the government. About 500,000 people have been displaced. At the same time, Cameroon hosts more than 270,000 refugees from the Central African Republic. Lowcock told the Security Council that the UN is seeking about $300 million to fund aid efforts. So far, only $38 million has been received. African countries have voiced concerns, saying the humanitarian crisis in Cameroon should not be politicized. China and Russia have warned against UN involvement in Cameroon's affairs. Algeria's populist movement has renewed its rejection of interim President Abdelkader Bensalah's new call for holding dialogue to discuss the country's political crisis and how to arrange the presidential elections scheduled for July 4th. But the Algerian chief of staff, who is managing the transition, is insisting on following the constitutional approach. The popular movement insists on choosing former Foreign Minister Ahmed Talib Ibrahimi to lead the transitional phase. Participants in the marches express their rejection of officials linked to the regime of former President Abdulaziz Bouteflika. Saeed Sadek, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, spoke to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about possible scenarios to end the current stalemate in Algeria.
The current Arab Spring wave is very different from what happened in 2011. We have learned the mistakes that happened in Libya, Egypt, Syria, Yemen. And so it is not a question that we have removed the president. We want to remove the system. And we cannot trust the system to manage the transition. And that is why the tension between the forces for change and democratization in Algeria will keep the pressure, because there is distrust between them and those who have been put in the throes of managing the transition. But of course, the military in Algeria has a point. They just say, look, the whole of the North Africa today is entering a stage of instability, and you cannot exclude the army. You cannot have immediate democracy just like that. Democratization takes time, and it's gradual, and you have to invest and involve everybody, the stakeholders. If you are going to make the army the arch enemy, and you will insist that all of the members of the Ancien regime are removed, then we are in a real crisis that can also lead to a setback in the Algerian revolution.
But the popular movement insists on choosing former Foreign Minister Ahmed Talib Ebrahimi to lead the transitional phase, as participants expressed their categorical rejection of the continuation of the symbols of the former regime of President Abdelaziz Bouteflika. Would that be a compromise?
If they accept, and to accept that, it means the street in Algeria has to keep the pressure, because only in this case the military will accept and will make the compromise. As we have seen, the Algerian revolution, like in a way the Sudanese, there was no much bloodshed. And so far, the Algerian revolution had been under the interest of the Tunisian. And so if they keep the pressure for peaceful transition, maybe they would be able to get a compromise and a movement forward. But again, we have to remember democratization is a long historical process. It is not going to be a smooth, linear movement. It can also have setbacks.
So what kind of efforts should be followed to find an alternative solution within the framework of the constitution, but with the nominating of agreed upon figures believed to be acceptable by both the people and the regime to manage this delicate stage?
First of all, they need trust. Trust is lacking. All those who made the revolution do not trust anybody from the old regime. And so those in the old regime who are in power need to give some guarantees. Of course, it is not the right thing that you get rid of the current constitution without providing an alternative, because you cannot stay in an illegal vacuum. So you need a general national debate about the component of the new state that should be emerging, the new system that would emerge. So there has to be more dialogue, open dialogue, so that ideas change, culture change, and the regime and those who are in power also do not fear that the change would lead to their own devastation, the destruction. You cannot ask people who are in power today that they surrender totally and accept all the what the revolution wants, and then in the end they will send themselves into the gallows. We have a democratic transition, a democratic revolution. They want the changing the system peacefully without any use of brute force.
That was Saeed Sadek, professor of political sociology at the American University in Cairo, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed Elshenawi. Business practices that respect the earth, protect human rights, promote fair labor, and fight corruption aren't just good for people and the environment, they are also excellent for a company's profitability. That's the bottom line for the United Nations Global Compact, an organization of nearly 14,000 companies worldwide that are committed to sustainable business practices and the achievement of societal goals. To find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Lisa Kingo, the UN Global Compact CEO and Executive Director, and the keynote speaker at a sustainability and innovation conference sponsored by the French-American Chamber of Commerce in New York. Kingo began by explaining the compact's popularity in the corporate world.
Companies are understanding more and more clearly that being a responsible business is part of doing business today. Employees are requesting this. The financial sector is requesting that companies have an approach to environment, to human rights, to labor, to anti-corruption. And we are seeing companies like BlackRock, for example, beginning to evaluate companies for their sustainability through the 10 principles of the Global Compact.
Help me to understand why companies might think it's in their best interest to be sustainable.
It's clear from our companies that they are performing better from a financial perspective. Their share price is outperforming the share price of companies that are not taking an ethical, social, responsible perspective. So there are very, very clear arguments.
I understand why holding these values might make them more attractive to certain investors and shareholders, but how do sustainable practices themselves make businesses more profitable?
I think it's at least three different things. It's an excellent way of managing risks, and it's also an excellent way of optimizing opportunities. For example, many companies looking at the 17 goals see that climate change, gender equality are themes that are crucial for future markets and for the world. They build into the business how to save energy. They make programs for how to put women on their top leadership programs. And both these things we can document is contributing to making a stronger financial bottom line. The third perspective is that running a business in a responsible way require that you are in close contact with all your stakeholders, not only with the regulators and with your shareholders, with customers, with prospective employees, with journalists. It's actually a very healthy and productive way of running a business.
Does this strategy only work for multinational corporations, or does it work for small companies and grassroots businesses?
Of course, the efforts can be scaled in different ways, but the thinking that the company must be a force for good, that's the same kind of thinking. Lately, I was in both Tanzania and Kenya, and I saw so many examples of great companies, both large and small, that are really picking up this agenda. And it's interesting because worldwide, 80% of our companies have picked up the goals, but in Africa, it's actually 85%. So I felt so inspired by the innovative spirit that the African companies have and the way they incorporate some of the social problems in Africa into their business strategies in a very natural way that we could learn a lot from in the northern part of the world.
Could you expand on that thought a little bit?
I see in many other countries that some people are expecting the government or the authorities to take care of social problems. That's not so much the case in many African countries. I mean, there everybody come together to deal with the challenges that are there, to think about what is it they can do to contribute to creating a more sustainable world, to the benefit of all of us as humans, but also to business and governments.
That was Lisa Kingo, CEO and Executive Director of the UN Global Compact, speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. Technology company Microsoft says it will invest $100 million in African development centers. The centers are expected to be in Kenya and Nigeria, the company says. Microsoft says it wants to hire 100 full-time engineers by the end of the year and expand that number to 500 by 2023. Microsoft official Phil Spencer said the ADC will be unlike any other existing investment on the continent. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta welcomed the effort, telling Spencer that he wanted Microsoft to be at home in Kenya. Microsoft says it will work with local universities to develop teaching plans. Needed skills included data science, artificial intelligence, and application development. The company said its investment is expected to be worth $100 million in the first 5 years. Microsoft's ADC investments are in addition to its announcement in March of the company's first African data centers in South Africa. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Patrick Deya, thanks for choosing Voice of America.
Hey, Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.